kind of lifestyle changes that you can make to improve improve your chances of succeeding in meditation. So the first one we talked about was staying in a conducive place. And do you remember the five parts of that? Or maybe one or two?
Yeah, just generally, what are some of the qualities?
Sleep, water, people,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good place, a safe place.
So they said some place where there's food and water, and where there's safe.
Yeah.
No wild animals. Yeah.
Friends, I think, was the last one.
Friends to support you, yeah, and to help you with things. Yep. You'd be surprised how dependent you are on others. Even though you're locked into a room, you really need people on the outside to help you out. Okay?
And then, does anyone remember the second one?
Easy,
there was
an easy... Oh, no, that's the first one.
Yeah. Live simply.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's okay.
That's fine. Notes are good.
So yeah.
Yep.
Be satisfied with what you have.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So be satisfied with whatever you have.
So then one that in New York is really hard for us, because we're New Yorkers, and it's really hard for me, even though, you know, every year I keep saying I'm going to simplify more and more, but not to be too busy with things, to give your mind the space to be able to meditate, to be able to give your mind the space so that it's not always running around, so that when you sit down, your mind isn't still running around for the 15 minutes that you're sitting down, so that there's space for it. It can go in deeper without thinking about what you have to do next or what you've just done. And then the next one I think is very, very, very important. Does anyone remember? Yes. Uh-huh. Follow your ethics. Don't harm other people. And does anybody remember why we say this step is very important? It seems like a stretch.
Yeah.
Like, why would not harming others help a meditation? I mean, you're just
your mind
sitting down.
Silence itself, if you've done something, you won't be able to find that place. It just won't exist.
Mm-hmm.
If you've done something very terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Speech wise as well.
Yeah.
Yep. Speaking harshly to people, it's hard to define the mind afterwards.
And then the last one?
Did I say it?
Did you say it?
Say it again.
The friends? No, no, no.
Oh, no,
I
that's...
thought that was the last one.
Anybody else?
That's right. Sense desires.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the 8-point posture. So this is a quick
one.
Thorough review. So the 8-point posture, your legs, full or half or no lotus, right? Your eyes, open or closed. Halfway open, not focusing on anything. Shoulders straight. And your hands, I don't know that we talked about this last time, but you can do the meditation hands that you'll see the Buddha doing in some of his tantras, but not in this room. Is it the left hand first?
Yes.
So the left hand first, and then the right hand, and your two thumbs together. Keeping your arms a little bit wider, especially now in the summer, because you tend to get hot if you're too closed off. Something nice in the summer is maybe just resting your hands on your legs. Really anything that's comfortable. Um, And then your head straight in a natural position, not too far up, not too far down, but just kind of straight ahead. Teeth and lips natural. And one aspect that we didn't talk about this seat, but you probably all know just by figuring it out, if you have your butt a little bit higher than the front of your body, it will help you to strain your spine. Some of us need more of a height than others. It just depends on the flexibility in your hips, so whatever you need to make that comfortable. Ah, good. Does anybody remember about the tongue?
The palate, the top upper palate. Just resting naturally on the upper palate. It does a funny thing, it prevents you from drooling. It allows your saliva to go back into your, you know, down your throat. Which in a 10-minute meditation isn't a problem, but remember, these are practices by yogis who meditate for days on end. And it's a real problem, I guess. So this, you know, it's a natural way to get the naturally occurring saliva to go back down into your throat. Has everyone found a good seat in your meditation at home and your daily practice? Because it's really important to kind of get that settled so that when you do sit down, you're not thinking about, should I have that cushion, this cushion, that cushion, this cushion. At a certain point, it's okay for a little while to find your tools and then settle on them and get comfortable. Like, we've got a lot of different tools here. Everyone's using different ways to sit. Okay.
Okay.
Have we finished the review?
Yeah.
Okay. Whoops. I just dropped it. What happened?
So, tonight we're going to talk about the top 5 problems in meditation. And like we mentioned before, this is like a top 5 list that was compiled by all the great meditation masters. So when we start meditating, they've pretty much come up with every single problem we could possibly have. So they've also come up with corrections to these 5 problems. And we're going to go over them. You know, it's going to be another couple of lists. But it's really important with these lists, when you're in your meditation, you have to learn how to make these lists work for you. You have to learn how, you know, we'll give a few examples, but do what works best for you, you know, because that's what we've done. We've internalized these lists. We've found this one works for me, this one doesn't. This one used to work for me, this one doesn't anymore. And that's the way that you make progress, and that's the way you make it your own practice, and you make it work for you. So, the first problem, which is probably one that I think we've all come across, is called Lelo in Sanskrit?
Tibetan.
And it means laziness. And this is not wanting to sit and meditate. This is thinking that you have something more important than sitting and meditating. This is getting too busy so you don't have time to sit and meditate. Basically, if you have the intention to meditate and you don't do it, it's probably because of laziness. And this is such a big problem that it has 4 antidotes, whereas all the other ones only have 1. So the first antidote is to, you kind of do a cost-benefit analysis. You know, what are the drawbacks of meditating? Anyone? If you haven't meditated, like, at least once since class started, there has to be a drawback why you didn't meditate.
It takes up time.
Yeah, it takes up time.
It takes up time.
Anything else?
Like, takes up sleep time.
Sleep time, that's quality time. So two time elements. What are the other downsides of meditation?
Downsides?
Mm-hmm. Like why, what are the bad things about meditation?
Like why wouldn't we do it? PND bar?
You're uncomfortable?
Physically?
It could be uncomfortable.
Yeah. For many people it's very difficult to sit still.
Mm-hmm.
And to sit comfortable.
Hard
to do?
It can be hard to do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does take effort.
Takes effort?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes it's not easy to look at yourself, like, quietly, sit quietly.
Ah.
You know?
It's tough to face yourself.
Yeah, sometimes, some days.
Yeah.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what are the benefits?
So, so then we think about the benefits, and has anybody yet seen some benefits to meditation or heard of benefits of meditation that made you want to come here and learn about meditation other than just curiosity? Have you heard any rumors about what meditation can do for you?
Just looking at yourself. There's great benefits to really looking at yourself.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So benefits from looking inward.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yes, I went with James and he said that in our practice there are ups and downs. Sometimes we get motivated to do it, not often. And then we get in a position where we lost the motivation. So we stop doing it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. Stop because when we say, oh, tomorrow I'm going to do it. Tomorrow morning, I'm tired now. So we like an excuse, but then when you do it again, you feel so good because you think, oh, I can do it all the time.
And
but,
that's that's really, really good.
It's
you
a great
say
place
you're going
to
do something and you do it, it makes you feel so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some of the other benefits are, it creates a sense of calmness within you. When you reach higher states of meditation, you get a certain mental stillness, which creates this sense of peace within you. It's easier to concentrate. And your mind is sharper. Basically, any task you undertake becomes that much easier to you because you are more focused and your mind is clearer and you're not so distracted by other things. It helps you become more creative, I've heard. but then there's also benefits along the spiritual path to meditation. Like, these are kind of worldly benefits that will definitely come if you start meditating. But some of the spiritual benefits are seeing emptiness directly, which I don't think we've talked about emptiness much in this class. But basically, it's seeing directly how your world works, seeing directly how we go through our day now, thinking that, if I'm short with somebody because I'm in a rush, or I push back past somebody on the subway because I'm in a rush and I need to get there, or I take the last donut because I'm hungry and I got there first. You see directly that that's a completely wrong way of thinking, that that's actually 180 degrees opposite of how your world works and how you get what you want and how you you know, how you can create a lasting sense of happiness in your world, how you can get anything that you want. The only way to move between these three scopes that we're talking about on the Lamrim is through a state of deep meditation. So you need to be able to meditate well to go from zero scope to the first scope, and then to the second scope we'll talk about tonight. And it really helps you in being able to keep your ethics, which we talked about, very important to keep your ethics if you want to meditate well. So it kind of becomes a cycle as well. So as we said, the first antidote is, you know, just be very logical with yourself. Look at the downsides to meditating. Look at the upsides of meditating and then make a choice. You know, are you going to do it? You know, decide once you've looked at the benefits and the downsides that you want to become a good meditator. Once you've decided that you want to do something, you'll definitely do it. Like, we do this in every aspect of our life. Once you decide you want to do it, you'll put the efforts forth that are necessary. You'll know that your practice goes up and down. You'll know that it won't be easy every day, but it won't matter to you because you've made that decision. Or maybe it will still be difficult, but maybe you'll meditate on one of those days that you didn't want to because you want to be a good meditator. You know that it won't be enjoyable, but you don't care because you just want to be a good meditator because you know the benefits. And then at some point, it's going to be pleasurable to meditate. It will be more pleasurable to sit and meditate than it will be to do whatever task you have to do next. And then it will be easy to meditate, you know. And then you can worry about some of the other problems of meditation that come up. So, because right now the biggest problem that we have is laziness, I think it's really important that every time you sit down in your cushion, even if you can't do the 15 minutes, even if you decide that you can only do 5 minutes, it's very important because we're training ourselves at this point to rejoice. Every time you sit down in your meditation cushion, rejoice. And like really believe that you're doing something. And really believe that you're doing something beneficial because you are. Because we're trying to build a habit. And the only thing that you need to do at this point to build the habit is to sit down. So if you do, even if you only come to your object of meditation once, which was maybe right when you sat down, like it doesn't matter, just rejoice that you sat down.
Yeah. Rejoicing is a big thing in our tradition.
When is it good to meditate, in the morning or at night?
It depends. You know, one in the city for us here in this room, it really depends on where what your schedule is like. I know people who are night people and they don't like to do things in the morning and they just want to take on the more important things in the evening. Some people are better at taking on their activities first thing, the most important things first thing in the day. There are also different, your mind goes through different phases, whether it's dawn or dusk or high noon or midnight. You know, your mind isn't like this throughout the day, right? It does change throughout different times of the day. So there is some sensitivity to that, but that's really based on the individual again. So it really comes down to whatever best suits you best. I think some of the important things is when you can be consistent in your schedule. If you're more consistent at dinner time than at breakfast, maybe that's the best time. So you have a regular habit to get into it and establish some practice, ease of coming, you know, going to meditation all the time and getting the benefits. So whatever suits your schedule the best.
I used to try to make
Is that after you wake up or before you go to bed?
No, normally sleep very late. I sleep at usually like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning.
So it's the last thing you do in the day.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And it's
right.
Much easier. Like,
yeah.
In the morning, it's hard to get my mind
mm-hmm.
in the right place. But at
yeah.
night, it's just
mm-hmm.
so easy.
My problem is that in the morning, I'm tired.
Uh-huh.
The end of the day, I'm like working, and that would be a great time to meditate, and the next time I'm tired again.
Uh-huh.
So, it's a problem of laziness, but I just find myself like, oh, I'm tired, I'll just do it tomorrow, and then tomorrow
yeah.
comes on.
But fortunately, there's no physical effort in meditating, really. You have to hold your back straight,
yeah.
but you can have physical tiredness, but you need some mental acuity.
I do sleep better.
Yeah.
And, you know, also at this stage of meditation where, you know, we're working on sitting down on the cushion, making a regular practice, we're working on bringing our mind back to the object, you know, it might be a good practice to do it while you're tired, because you think that you think that maybe you can't, you think maybe it's not ideal if you're tired, so try it, you know, and see what happens.
Okay, so let's go. Melissa just covered the first of the five problems, and then four antidotes to it, or four corrections to that problem. So here's the second problem, and that is when you sit down to meditate. You close your eyes, and we're kind of getting used to the preliminaries now, and you may have to cheat and look at that number six and stuff like that, but then you do, and then you look down, and you're like, okay, great, you know, okay, I'm in the forest, and then there's a clearing over there, and I look at the clearing over there, and then, oh, second, what am I looking at again? What's for lunch? Oh, I got to do that before I go to work, you know, and you just go off. And you just go off, right? And the formal word for problem number two is forgetting the instructions, right? You're just forgetting what you're there to do. You're losing the object of your meditation, okay? And our object for this course is the Lam Rim, which is a nice structured review. And then we break off and do analytical meditations at certain points, like a death meditation or a meditation on suffering, like we'll introduce tonight. But you just like wander off. Your mind goes off. And this is normal, okay? Your mind, as a normal, regular person walking and working through a very hectic day in New York, is going to be constantly distracted every few seconds. When you try to hold your mind on something for as long as 60 seconds even, it's very hard. Try to count and maintain awareness of your breath and your count for 10 breaths without losing your mental focus on that object of breath. And it's hard. Like you get to two or three and you fall off. So the same thing is going to happen with your object of meditation of the Lam Rim. And do not beat yourself up at this point, right? Just coax your mind back. I used to smile at myself, like, oh my God, I already got through dinner and I haven't even started breakfast. And I've just eaten my whole way through in my mind, right? So I smile, right? And then you bring yourself back gently. Don't really beat yourself up at this point about why you're losing the object of meditation. So what's the antidote? You know, we're going to get into some specific antidotes for different types of ways that you can lose the object. But the general antidote or the correction for forgetting the instruction is to maintain an awareness of yourself while meditating and seeing how close you are to staying focused on the object. So they call it recollection, right? But what you're trying to do is recall if your mind is on the object or if your mind is off the object. And the way to best do this is to kind of keep a fraction of your mental awareness, almost like up here, watching you meditate. And this watcher being up here is kind of the one that's going to do the recalling. It's going to say, oh, you're off the object, oh, you're off the object, you know? And that recollection comes from an awareness of yourself while meditating. and your particularly your ability to focus on the object of meditation.
So, the state of mind that we're going for in meditation, the state of mind that you use, they say is clear and bright and focused. So, then the next problem we come up against is that, you know, your mind is not clear and bright and focused. It's either dull, so it's not clear and bright, or it's agitated, which means it's like, you know, well, I don't know if it's too clear or too bright, but it's definitely too active. You know, you're not focused on your meditation. So you can have gross dullness, which would be the kind of dullness that you would feel if you don't get enough sleep the night before and you try to meditate. If you try to meditate in an overheated room, or you just had a huge greasy meal before you sit down and meditate, that would be gross dullness, you know? And then the subtle dullness, they say is a meditator's biggest enemy because it's very difficult to identify while you're in meditation. And Geshe Michael and Lama Christy gave the advice that sometimes it's easier to see when you're not meditating whether or not you might have subtle dullness while you're meditating. And subtle dullness is a problem that we probably won't encounter until maybe you're on a long retreat. Then maybe you'll be able to see it. But it's basically, it makes your mind forgetful. And it says that you lose your intellect. So, for example, if you're on a meditation retreat and you put your cup down, but you don't remember where you put it down, and you actually don't even remember moving it from where you originally had it, that's the kind of sign that might come up if you have subtle dullness in your meditation. So if you notice that outside of meditation, maybe you want to try to correct for that when you sit down on the cushion and start meditating. And then we have gross agitation, which is what Michael talked about. You know, you're sitting down to meditate, and, you know, you start thinking about your future plans. You start replaying something that somebody said to you. You know, yesterday you recall a fight that you had with somebody. Basically, it's when you're thinking about something other than your meditation object. Another type of agitation that can occur is that it's easy to see when you're doing a visualization, or if you're like trying to count your breath, your mind basically will bounce off the object. You try to focus, and your mind bounces off that object. That's another manifestation of agitation. So the correction for agitation and dullness are what Michael talked about, watchfulness. You know, make sure that while you're meditating, you have this part of your mind that is watching you while you meditate. And that way you can identify whether or not you have agitation or dullness.
Okay. So that was the third problem. So now we're on the fourth problem. It's an interesting one. As we escalate through these, the last one she said was, oh my God, I've got subtle dullness or subtle agitation, or and gross forms are the same. The fourth one is not doing anything about the problems that you've just identified about. So it's called failing to take action. So all of this is leading to a very active mind during meditation. For at this early stage, it's really helpful to get your point, your mind to a certain point of concentration, and then you can shift into subtler modes. But right now, we're trying to harness a corral of wild horses, and we've really got to stay on top of it. So this one is okay, I got a problem, I've identified it, then what are my next steps? And this is, so failing to take any next steps to correct any of the problems is what the, is a problem in itself. So there's two steps to this. There's failing to take action against dullness, and there's failing to take action against agitation. So in the first one, the failing to take action against dullness, if your dullness is not so great, you can simply just fine-tune it. Say like a guitar string, you know, just tune it down a little bit. Or you can say to your mind, okay, now come on, stay on track, stay on track. You know, you're just kind of guiding it between going on and off, okay? And if you're at that point, you can use your little watch yourself to recollect and always to stay on, always to stay on. And you're just basically fine-tuning your intensity on the object. More gross forms of subtle dullness need greater action to take against. So the action could involve changing the actual object of meditation for a short period of time. So you may temporarily move off of the long rim and move towards something like a bright object to uplift yourself. This is in the case of dullness. Dullness is a downer, so you kind of want to do the antidote, right? So maybe you want to think of something bright like the sun. You ever stare at the sun, it just kind of is really bright and it kind of internally lightens you up. Additionally, your physical posture is really important as well. I find if I'm dullness, I'm all of a sudden, if I had any awareness of my body, I'd be slouching and I'd be looking down. So then you kind of like reinvigorate your body and get it strong again. Make sure your shoulders are level and your back is straight and your chin is level. And you may even want to look your chin up a little bit to counter any kind of dullness. They say if your chin is down, you have a tendency to get dull. And if it's too high, you have a tendency towards agitation. So just right. As an antidote, you can go the other way a little bit to balance things out. Okay. Another way to take action is to go back to the first one and think of the benefits of the meditation. The purpose there is to inspire you a little bit, to get back onto the object, right? So, in terms of taking action against agitation, you can loosen up a little bit. Sometimes agitation comes from trying to put things too intensely on the object, and you're just, and you go into it too intense, and all of a sudden, as Melissa said, you bounce off. So sometimes the antidote for too much agitation is just to lighten up. You know, that's the action. Chill out, relax a little bit, and don't push as hard and towards that intensity of that object. You could do things to still your mind. Whether, you know, as you mentioned, meditating stills your mind before sleep, you can do some other things to kind of get your mind to a point of equilibrium. One is to count your breaths again. So once again, temporarily moving off the object, which is lam rim for us, and say, I'm going to count my breath to 10. And I'm just going to make sure that I can feel the sensation of the inhalation and the exhalation for 10 counts, so that I call the breath a handrail for the mind, to get on track. And then when it's on track and you've done your 10, then you switch back to the lam rim. Okay? So it's a way to keep your mind from skipping all over the place in an agitated mind by giving yourself something very strong to hold on to, which is your breath. Yeah, let's leave it at that for now.
And then the final problem is... this is a problem that you'll have when you're really good at meditation. And that is, you know, we've applied these corrections for mental dullness and agitation, and then you keep applying these antidotes when you don't need to. You keep taking action when your mind is at an equilibrium. And so the antidote for this problem is to just stop, you know, to stop making corrections, leave well enough alone. You know, you recognize that you're at an equipoise, and then just let go of your corrections. Just meditate.
It's a nice correction.
What is it called?
The problem is called taking action where none is needed, and the solution is leave well enough alone. Technically.
Don't act. Okay. those are the five problems in need corrections. And you'll be going through these at all levels of your meditative career. Even advanced meditators go through these three and apply the antidotes accordingly. They're the same problems for everyone, whether you're a beginner or an advanced meditator. So, should we do a brief review and then into the second stage? Okay. We're a little bit behind. So, right now, we're going to now switch gears, and we talked about the second scope of the Lam Rim. And to get there, I want to review where we were. For people who weren't even here the first 3 weeks, but you probably know the Lam Rim. So the first step of the Lam Rim was what? Grounding. Huh? Oh, correct. Okay, sorry. And the actual Lam Rim, that's the meditation aspect. And the forest represents something. But in the Lam Rim, in the steps towards path to enlightenment, what is the very first thing in the foundation that you'll need to get you there? No? Who is it that crosses the river that guides you?
Teacher.
Right. Bless me to see that every good thing in my life comes from my Lama. All right. Everything comes from that. So the very first step of the Lam Rim is to find a teacher. You know, they say Lama, there's so many words. There's guru in Sanskrit, there's, you know, your teacher, rishi, sage, anyone. Somebody is the foundation of the path. The implication is you can't do it alone. Okay? If we could, we would. And we wouldn't need any of this and we'd all be enlightened beings. The reason we're not enlightened beings is because we haven't had the teachings and we do not have the skills to do this on our own. Okay? We need a teacher. So that's really the very first step of the Lama Rim, and then Lama Rim says everything else is after that. So after that, remember what we went into it all? We talked about leisure and fortune. The idea for those on the first scope is to understand and appreciate your current life. Okay, you want to understand that you've got unique opportunities in this life that you don't have anywhere else. Okay, you've got to take advantage of these opportunities. Do not waste time. Do not stop at go. And just go as fast as you can and as far as you need to in order for those in the lower scope, avoid a rebirth in a suffering realm or a lower realm. Okay? I think that's all we covered previously was that. One of the ways of understanding your leisure and fortune is understanding... We did a little bit of a death awareness, right? We understand that death is certain. It creates a sense of fortune in our lives. We haven't died yet. We understand that we don't know when we're going to die, right? And then we all have the fortune of being here now. And we've also stated that at the time of death, the only thing that will help us are the jewels that we picked up near our coffin and wore as our robe, right, as part of that meditation. Because those are the only things that will help you at the time of death. Because it is your good deeds that ripen at the time of death, which will help you in that time and then in your next life. Okay? And that's why one of the reasons why they say that the only thing that can help you at the time of death is your dharma, the dharma that you've studied, and the realizations that you've had in your lifetime. Okay? So that's a review of the Lam Rim to date and the Lam Rim. And the scope of those shared by the lesser scope. Now we're going to move into the path shared with those of the medium scope. And the medium scope practitioners are defined as those who want to avoid a rebirth altogether. Okay? Lower scope, they just didn't want a lower rebirth. They'll take a higher rebirth. Okay? But we say a higher rebirth will eventually end up in suffering anyways. A higher rebirth in a God realm or in a formless realm, that karma runs out, the causes for that run out, and then you're left with a lower rebirth. So that's not sufficient, okay? What we want to do is escape rebirths altogether as a medium scope practitioner. We want to reach what's called nirvana, or peace, a place beyond all mental affliction obstacles. Nirvana is defined as the cessation of mental affliction obstacles. So, there is no suffering in nirvana, right? You have eliminated all of the things which cause suffering. So to get there, we need to consider our own suffering, okay? So we're going to talk a little bit about a high level tonight of what it is our suffering is. And this is very interesting. There's a very detailed description of suffering in our world. Samsara is described as a world of cyclic suffering existence. We're going to introduce it at three levels. There is the suffering of suffering, there is the suffering of change, and then there is pervasive suffering. And we're going to group all suffering into these types of categories, okay? We're also going to combine it with the four Arya truths. People know the four noble truths? Let's review them. The first one is?
Life is suffering.
Life is suffering. And the second one? There is a cause for suffering. And the third one? Correct. There's an end to suffering. And the fourth one? There's a path to the end of suffering. Okay? So it's very significant that Lord Buddha, the history for the four Arya truths is at the point of his enlightenment, he was asked to teach afterwards, and the first thing he taught afterwards were these four Arya truths, right? After his realization of Aryahood and the point of seeing and reaching, in this case, total enlightenment, he spoke these truths. And he started with really an effect. Life is suffering, right? It's an effect. The cause comes second, really interestingly enough. And he teaches the effect first, that life is suffering, so that people have the willingness to get out of suffering and to look towards the cause and the end and the path to eliminate the first thing, which is suffering itself. Okay? So keep that in mind as we go through these three categories of suffering. So the first one is suffering of suffering. In a way, it's gross suffering. It's the common ones you know about. If I break my leg, it hurts. Right, if somebody close to us passes away, we're of emotional pain. Right, if we lose somebody in our lives, a natural disaster happens in the world, we feel it. Right, these are kinds of gross suffering. If we cut ourselves, we are in pain. It's kind of obvious suffering. It's sometimes called the suffering of suffering. In a way, this is every unpleasant action. Is We're going to split things up into pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, right? Everything can be divided into these types of references. When we interact with our world through our sense perceptions, we either react neutrally, like, you know, I don't really care about the shirt I'm wearing. I don't care about things. I'm neutral to it. I have unpleasant reactions to, obviously, pain and suffering. And I have pleasant reactions to the relief of that pain and suffering. So the first one of suffering is the realm of unpleasant activities. It's our reaction to things in an unpleasant way. If I break my leg, I'm having an unpleasant reaction, a sense experience to my world at that point in time, right? The second one is called the suffering of change. And the suffering of change is really the awareness that the pleasant things in life do not last. Nothing lasts forever in a pleasant way. And that change from pleasant only goes back to unpleasant. So the suffering of change is really the realization of my world and interacting with it through my sense perceptions and the pleasant things that I experience in life. Every good thing that I've ever had in my life did not last. Okay? And either they burn out into a neutral state, like I'm glad high school didn't last, right? But, you know, there are some things that burn out into a negative state. We can, tons of examples here. Geshe Michael likes to refer to food a lot. His favorite is ice cream, right? He can get ice cream anywhere within 10 miles. It's definitely on his plate. So anyways, he would love to sit down, craving for ice cream in the middle of the desert. He'd sit down, it's Cherry Garcia, his favorite. And he hasn't had it for a week, and it's a special celebration day, and he just loves the ice cream. He eats it. First quart, pretty good. He starts to get a little full. Well, there's another quart there. It's the same ice cream. He keeps eating more of it. It's a stomachache. Right? So what's up with that? You know, something pleasant became unpleasant. Right? The relief of hunger and craving for ice cream became suffering in and of itself over time. So they say that the suffering of change is basically an escape from suffering itself. Because our endemic world, and this is the third one, the pervasive suffering, and samsara, everything about this world is suffering. And we'll talk a little bit about why in a bit. But because it is, we do have escapes from the suffering. Like if you're hungry and you get a meal, that hunger is gone, right? And that hunger was the suffering. So it's temporarily alleviated. But then you're hungry again in 8 hours, right? So they say that pleasurable objects is only the temporary alleviation of a suffering existence. All right? Because underlying everything is a suffering world. So in relation to the four Arya truths, we've looked at pleasant things as, well, okay, so let me go back and say why things are always suffering. You know, there are causes for all of this suffering. Where nothing comes without a reason. There's no reason why there is a reason why there is suffering in this world. And we have actually three quick options here. Okay? First option is things are random. Okay? My knee hurts now because I don't know why. It's random, right? Or I got hungry before class. I get hungry every day at 6 because it's random, right? Or this person died randomly, right? You know, things don't... We can't ascribe to that. We wouldn't go to work every day and expect a paycheck on Friday if we believed in a random world, right? We actually have this belief that going to work causes a paycheck, right? And there's this linear cause and effect belief. We do live our lives through cause and effect. I eat a hamburger, I won't be hungry. Cause and effect, right? We live our world this way. We don't live in a world of a random worldview. Another worldview that would answer a cause for suffering would be there's an evil creator being who wishes this baby to die, or this person to have cancer, or this person to break their leg, or this person to lose a loved one. Okay, and I don't think any one of us are sadistic enough to think that any creator being would will any kind of harm on anything they've created. Okay. So we've eliminated a worldview of like things are totally random. We've eliminated the worldview of a creator being as a cause of suffering. So the third option we propose is that we're the cause of our own suffering. Okay? In a world of causality, everything that appears and I interact with in my world, including my being here and you out there, my thoughts, are entirely caused by my previous events. Okay? I and my world are caused events. If I live in a suffering world, okay, I've identified the cause, what's the end of suffering? The third Arya truth. Eliminate the causes. If you change your causes, you will change your results. This enlightened being simply changed their result, their causes, sorry, and they achieved a different result. Instead of having an end life of suffering and death, you can end your world in a total blissful state in paradise by simply creating the causes. The reason why total enlightenment is possible is because there are causes for that enlightened state. And if all you have to do is work on those causes and you will get those results. Okay? Cause and effect. Cause and effect. We live our lives that way every day anyways. We should take it more seriously in how we actually do things and change our world. Your world will shift as soon as you start changing your causes. Okay. So what is the path to the end of the suffering? How do you change your world? How do you end suffering? Sorry?
Try to eliminate as much desire and aversion as possible. Like the two extremes of the middle path. Right?
Yeah. Eliminating ignorance towards things that you're attached to. Desirous elements, or even ignorance towards things you don't like, too. You have to treat them equally, like in a middle way. And one of the ways that guides that principle is what they call wisdom. Okay, they say wisdom is the path to the end of suffering. Wisdom is the fourth Arya truth. This path to end of suffering is understanding how your world works. And we paint it in two pictures. The positive side is understanding causality, like I just mentioned, cause and effect, and how things arise in your world. The other component is understanding the true nature of reality which supports causality. If I was a certain being, inherently, self-existently, always a certain way, I could never change. How can causality work on things that don't change? How can causality work on things that have an intrinsic nature? If everything has a nature of its own, then there's no way that causality can change that. Okay? And there's an understanding of the true nature of things, of lacking a self-existent nature, that allows for causality to occur and for you to change your world because things can change. Okay? Because things aren't self-existent one way or another. Or your screaming partner would always be your screaming partner and you never had a good day. You know, we understand change. We have to apply how things change in the world. So as we... okay, let's see. All right, so maybe I'll introduce the fourth room, the room, the second room. Or do we want to do a review? Let me go one step further. For the visualization for the Lam Rim that we're doing, beyond the forest and the river and everything else, we're introducing another room. The first room was the triangle, right? The yellow door, and it represented practitioners of the lesser scope. Now we're introducing another room, door number two, and it starts with a hall of mirrors. Okay? I'm sorry, just a hall of glass. It's not a mirrors. And the hall of glass is a... is all of your things in your life. Okay? You're going to visualize everything that you've collected up till now. Right? All of your objects. All of the people you love. All your photographs from your past. All of your memories are going to be lined up. And you're going to see them change. Okay? And this is the suffering of change. You're going to see them over time. And you're going to see how they change, and you're going to see your interaction, reaction, attachment to these things that bring you pleasure change. That's just a hallway. We'll go into more detail later. And then you enter a room, a circular room of mirrors. Okay? And the mirrors reflect this worldview of causality, that everything in your life is a reflection of what you've done. And in particular, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, what you've done to others. Master Shanti Deva says, further, if you've, every good thing you've done in your life comes from having done good things to others in the past. Every bad thing that ever happens to you in your life is from things you did selfishly in your past. Okay? So there's a reference here to this room of mirrors to how you've treated others. Okay? Your interaction with others. And you're going to be looking at that and applying this worldview of causality and reflection of how you've created your world and how you can eliminate suffering by eliminating what goes into the mirrors, because that's what's going to be reflected back to you. So we're going to, that's our visualization for this second scope of the Lam Rim. Okay, in the meditation. Oh, now? Okay. What are the pedestals? What do they represent? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Melissa says one important thing. In this room of mirrors, this round room of mirrors, there are pedestals. And on it are very fragile objects. And the pedestals aren't these great big museum ones. They're kind of fragile. They're kind of like precariously balanced. So we have to be careful how we move around this world, which is a metaphor for how we have to live our lives in our daily lives, in our daily world. And we have to be very careful about how we interact with others through our three doors of body, speech, and mind. And that's referenced by how we have to move around this round room and these fragile pedestals with objects on them.
So we'll take like 5 or 7 minutes. You can stretch your legs and eat sugar before meditating and go to the bathroom.
Yeah. So P and D bar, we're going to take a 5-minute break. And we'll come back and we'll do a meditation. Are we going to do it over here? Do you think we have time?
I don't think so. It's up to you if you think that we...
I think we have to get into meditation. Some of this review of what the dark forest has turned on the other room, I can talk about it.
Yeah.
Are they on?
I don't know. I don't know how it works, so I don't know. And then, so the other thing is.
Oh, they're offline.
So the other thing would be that, walking carefully on the pedestals is what you talked about,
mm-hmm.
but then you're also supposed to call to mind these trainings.
Oh, I forgot that's your trainings, yeah.
So you can.
Okay, I'll do it in the meditation. Let me read two verses from the Source of All My Good that refer to practitioners on the second scope. Everyone has found this material in the appendix of the reading? Okay. Verses 5 and 6. Bless me to perceive all that's wrong with the seemingly good things of this life. I can never get enough of them. They cannot be trusted. They are the door to every pain I have. Grant me then to strive instead for the happiness of freedom. Grant that these pure thoughts may lead me to be watchful and to recall what I should be doing. Grant me to give the greatest care to make the vows of morality the essence of my practice, for they are the root of the Buddha's teachings. So, these two verses in the Source of All My Good refer to the second scope of the Long Rim. So now we'll do a guided meditation. Right? Is the air conditioning a distraction for people? We can turn it off so that a little more sun. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, John. It probably helps with the audio recording a lot if anyone is trying to listen to these. Okay. So we're going to... we'll do the preliminaries... pretty quickly, everyone should be pretty familiar with them. And then we'll do a little fidget break if you want. You can, not get up, but you can move your legs and move your knees if you need to. And then we'll stay in our seat, and then we'll come back, and we'll do the meditation. We'll start with all the visualization that we've been doing for the last week, and then I'll add another little bit to it. Okay? Cool. We've got a breeze. Alright, so, and for this, try to stay still aside from the wiggle break if you can. It just helps still the mind if your body is still. So quickly, we're already seated down, so just come into your comfortable seated position that you have, and make sure your body is in the best accord with the 8 steps that we talked about earlier. Primarily, make sure that your back is straight. Creates alertness and it creates the subtle flow within the body in a conducive way. Just take a couple seconds to bring your mind back to your breath. Try to experience the sensation as it comes in and out of your nose. So we'll start with a notion or motivation of refuge. refuge here in your meditation practice. Think of the benefits of meditation, how it can help you throughout your current day, and how it's going to help you at the most important time of your life. Let's further our motivation to doing this practice, coming here on a Wednesday night, trying to keep a daily meditation practice, not for ourselves, but for others, as the reason why we're doing what we're doing. See and think about how meditation will help you help others in a much more effective way. Bring to mind someone in front of you that you rever and have a special relationship with and admire their qualities. And be sure that they're, you understand and feel their presence in front of you. Be humbled in front of them. And as an act of humility and recognition of their enlightened qualities, in your mind, prostrate yourself in front of them as a form of respect for what they have done in their lives and where they are in their spiritual career. Next, if you know what this being in front of you would like, make an offering of that to them. Fill the whole sky, fill the oceans, fill all of the lands of this earth, and the entire universe with this offering to them. And make it from your heart. Sometimes the most precious offering is the offering of your own practice. Then in front of this holy being that you respect, bring to your mind an act of body, speech, or mind done recently that you'd like to purify. And go through your own steps for the four ways of purifying this. Then with that purification complete, rejoice in the efforts you are making, in particular the efforts in your meditation practice, which should be fundamental for all of your spiritual realizations. Then in front of the holy being who has the qualities that you admire the most, ask that they teach you. In particular, ask that they teach you the path that got them to their realizations to attain the same qualities that you admire in them. And in order for them to teach you, you have to have them here, so you ask them to stay. Stay in your world, stay in your life, because without them, you will not make any progress on the path. Now dedicate the virtue from these seven ingredients which you've just done give it away. Therefore, the good deeds that you've done and the causes you've created from these seven steps is committed and will not go away. If you need to adjust your physical posture, you can do a fidget break here. Then we'll start in on the long rain meditation. So as we started last week, begin your visualization in a forest. And the forest is a representation of ignorance itself. Ignorance is considered to be if you will, the core affliction, that which underlies all other mental afflictions is root ignorance itself. So seeing yourself in this dark forest, have a sense of fear as well, of truly being lost, truly being alone, without help, without a guide, and afraid of the results of being in this forest. Of ignorance. Then as you walk over to a hill, you see a little clearing, and immediately you see it as a sense of relief, and you have hope in this clearing. It's a hope that it will relieve your fear and suffering from being in this forest of ignorance, and you go there, and within this shore which you've arrived at through the clearing, you look across a body of water and you see an island there, and you see a castle. And the castle on the other side represents the Lamrim itself, the steps on the path. And then you see a boat and a person in the boat. And you see, you have the sense of hope again that they will lead you off this island of ignorance. And you wave to them and they wave back. And they get in the boat and they start coming to you. And you have this great refuge in this being coming over. Refuge in that they will shelter you from that which hurts you the most. And as they come, see them as your teacher, as the way out of ignorance, as the way, as the guide on the path to enlightenment. And because you see them in this way, think of them in the highest way they could possibly appear, which is as an emanation of an enlightened being themselves. And as you would in front of an enlightened being, you would think of all of the ways you could serve them in your thoughts and in your deeds. And you think about this as the Holy Lama comes across in the boat. As you get in the boat, you cross the sea, and you see a turtle come up. And this turtle has a golden ring around its neck. And it's just popped up in this golden ring, and then it's gone again. And you have to realize that that is you. That is your leisure and fortune. That is your rare opportunity that this blind turtle came up from the bottom of the ocean and found its way into this golden necklace. And the chances of that happening are the same chances that you have of attaining another very fortuitous human rebirth again. And this should instill in you a sense of desire to use the most out of this life. you get to the other shore, the Lama helps you out of the boat, and he's holding your hand, they're holding your hand, and they guide you up to what looks from the outside to be a triangular building, and it's a yellow door. And this space represents the path of the Long Rim shared by those of the lesser scope. And because of the fear of the ignorance that you came through and the opportunities that you realize in this one life you have now, you start with the motivation of never going back. Never going back to a world of suffering, of pain, or anything, any of the lower realms that are possible. You enter this room. The first thing you see is a glass coffin. In this coffin is yourself. And not in a morbid way, just understanding that, like every other being on this planet, in this realm, your life here will also change. There's nothing guaranteed about your life, and that you too will die. Okay. You are not an exception. Just understand the truth of your own death. In this life, we interact with our world through our doors of body, speech, and mind. We are constantly collecting good deeds and bad deeds. To the left of the coffin is our collection of bad deeds. They're the things that you dislike the most. If it's spiders or snakes or bugs or bad dreams or evil people, they are on the left. Have a desire to purify yourself of these things from your world. You regret having committed these bad deeds. You don't want them to ripen. You don't want to see the reflection coming back to you in your future world. So you take a handful of these. Go to the upper left corner where there's a fire. As part of the purification, we burn and eliminate and remove these negative deeds which you've done in the past. When you throw them in, understand the four powers of purification. And an important fifth element of the purification process is to reconfirm to yourself that they are gone. Don't carry the baggage of these bad deeds anymore. Be rid of them once and for all. Feel purified. Feel cleaner. Feel more clear about things. Be glad of that purification. Go back to the coffin. And on the right side, you see all of the good things you've done. And these are represented by things that you like. Maybe it's ice cream. Maybe it's jewels. Maybe it's light. Maybe it's people that you love. And see them as a result of how you've treated others in the past. How you've served them above serving yourself. Bring them up into your arms and walk up to the upper right corner of the triangle. And there's a robe. Put all of these things and these good deeds that you've done in kind of embed them in the robe. Maybe it's full of pockets all over. And then you put the robe on. And understand that these are the things that will help you at the time of death. This is how the very deeds which you undertake in this life serve to help you at this most important time, which is at the very time of your death. Nothing else can help you except how you've treated others. Now your Holy Lama is still with you. See them in the room there. And see them smiling at you. And their hands are clasped at their heart. And they're very happy with you. They like what you've done. They like to see your spiritual progress through this stage of the long run. And they reach out their hand and you take it. And they say, come on, let's go to the next level. And you exit that room. And outside of that is another door. And it represents the scope of the long room shared with those of medium capacity. And as you go through that door, there's a long hallway which your Lama guides you through, and you have a lot of faith in your Lama now. You know that you're only going to achieve your spiritual path as a result of your devotion to the Lama. And you willingly go where they go. And they bring you to this long hallway. And they point to both sides. And it's a collection of everything you've accumulated in your life. From objects, cars, motorcycles, books, to people, all of the people we've known, all the people we've been in relationships with, all the people we've cared about and fought against and loved, all the money we ever earned is in one corner. And this is a collection of everything in our life. And then he snaps his finger. And immediately, 1 year has passed. And we see what's happened to all of these. They snap their finger again, and 5 years has passed, and 20 years, 50 years. In a time machine, we see how we change, and our reaction to these things change based on time. We see the people around us that we once loved and brought such pleasure to us have died. We see the old bicycle which we used to love and cherish gone, is totally rusted piece of crap. A car that we spent huge amounts of money on just puttered in the corner, just rotting away on old tires. None of these things have any meaning over time. So your Lama takes your hand and he goes, takes you in to the next room, which is a round room full of mirrors. As we said, this room represents the worldview of causality, how our world is echoed back to us based on what we've done to others in the past. And the mirrors represent everything being reflected back to us. Because of this, we have to be very careful about how we interact with others in our day-to-day world now. And this is represented by these columns in the middle of the room with extremely fragile objects on the top. And we have to move gently. We have to move consciously. We have to move very knowingly throughout this room as a metaphor for how we have to live our day.
We have to be very careful about how we act and how we talk to others and what we think about and what we prioritize and what becomes important for us. Because this is exactly what will be reflected back to us in our future. To help guide us through this maze of this room with all of the mirrors are what's called the three trainings. There's the training of ethics about how to treat others. There's the training in meditative concentration, which is what we're learning about in this course. And then there's the training in wisdom, which is the path to the end of suffering, which is the correct view of how you and your entire world works. So resolve to take personal responsibility for how you treat others in every day now, with the awareness and wisdom of the fact that everything you do now will only come back like a reflection in a mirror. See your Lama. See them smiling at your commitment and your resolve. And thank them for showing you this room and guiding you on the path and showing you these steps. So coming back in your meditation, return to the visualization of the holy being you brought in front of you. Your request to ask them to stay, and then your desire to attain the same attainments they've had, ask them to come inside of you. And they smile because you asked. And see them get smaller and smaller, kind of like melted butter, come down from the top of your head and down a little tube that comes in front of your spine to a place inside of your heart area. And understand, as this holy being dissolves into you, you take on their qualities and their realizations. You are transformed. You have everything that you strive for, everything that you saw in them that you strive for, you have attained. From the holy being in your heart, send out light. It totally fills your outer shell. And everything about your former body is gone, and you just become a body of light, a being of pure essence, free of any pain and suffering. See the light going further outside of you and filling this room, filling Manhattan, filling the five boroughs. 8 million people are touched by your light coming out. And when they're touched by it, they're transformed as well, in the same way that you were transformed by the holy being coming inside of you. Send this light over the entire continent, the entire planet, every being transformed, not just humans, every being in the ocean, every being in the sky, every being on land. Send it out beyond this earth to all the planets that you know about and to all the planets you don't know about. Now dedicate the virtue from this meditation. Dedicated to your success in your meditation practice, so that you can truly become a being who will change your yourself and every being in your world just like you visualize. Come back into the room, start to wiggle your body a little bit, and when you're ready, you can open your eyes. Melissa was going to have just a few just a minute on some ways to carry your meditation throughout the day.
So, there's any part of these meditations that you really enjoy? Maybe one of the rooms that is particularly special to you. You can try to take that into your daily life. You know, maybe seeing how, as you're walking through your day, how something might be a reflection of something you've done in the past. You know, kind of a benefit of the doubt, or maybe you're a little curious, you know, think maybe this situation, whether it's positive or negative, maybe this could really be my doing. You know, maybe if you like the beginning of the meditation where we focus on our breath as you're walking around, instead of going through your day or, you know, just thinking about whatever you think about when you're going to the subway, you know, watch your breath. Maybe if you really enjoy having your teacher in your heart or being close to them, like holding their hand where you're walking around, think of them as you're going throughout your day. You know, think of them being happy when you're happy. Think of them, you know, ask them for help when you're having a hard time throughout the day and imagine that they can help you. But, you know, any of these things, try to make it fun, and it will help you in your sitting meditation if you can, you know, kind of bring to mind some of these things that we're thinking about for 15 minutes a day. You know, if you bring them constantly back into your mind, it will help you in your meditation. So.
Meditation isn't just on the cushion anymore. Mm-hmm. All day long. Okay. Thanks, everyone. I know we're late. So we have been sending out links to the audio files. If you